This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is Lana. Sit back and relax because one of my favorites is back on Radio 314, John Rappaport. He has worked as a freelance investigative reporter for over 30 years. So as you can imagine, he has some valuable things to share at the age of 75. So listen up because we're revisiting the subject of collectivism. Collectivism means the subjugation of the individual to a group, whether to a race, class, or state, it does not matter. Collectivism holds that a man must be chained to collective action and collective thought for the sake of what is called the common good. It's a one-size-fits-all solution, which of course does not exist. Remember, Soviet Russia was a country professedly dedicated to the common good, where with the exception of a minuscule clique of rulers, the entire population existed in subhuman misery for over two generations. The common good has served as the moral justification of most social systems and of all tyrannies in history. The common good, or the public interest, is an undefined and undefinable concept. There is no such entity as society, or the public, or us. The group is only a number of individual men. Nothing could be good for the tribe, as good pertains only to a living organism, to an individual living organism, not to a disembodied aggregate of relationships. John, welcome back. I'm so glad to have a sane voice of reason back on my program. It seems the majority of people I speak to are blinded by the false promises of collectivism and false unity. It's the new religion, the new paradigm everyone's been asking for.
Yeah, that's a good intro. Everyone is asking for it. It comes out of despair, I think, on the part of a lot of people, because they're grasping at straws, thinking that somehow if we just think about everybody all together like one giant mass of oatmeal, that this is going to somehow solve the problems of the world and everything is going to work out just fine. And, it is the major delusion of our times, I would say.
I agree. Well, the last time you were on this program, we discussed various guises of collectivism and how it seeks to swallow people up. So let's jump into this collectivist conspiracy, because I know you have some new angles to share, including information passed to you by a retired propaganda master.
Yes. Well, let's start with a little bit of history. Before the end of World War II, actually on the eve of World War II, the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, which I'm sure many of your listeners know is a Rockefeller organization, decided that they had to plan for post-war society. And so they put together a committee, and the central question was, could the United States survive as an isolated country, or would it need resources that demanded that it go outside its own borders? And so naturally the answer was yes, we have to find resources that exist outside the country. And this was kind of a charade, really, because the answer was a foregone conclusion. And what it really came down to was America would have to become an imperial empire and control the entire world to make sure that it had continuing access to all these resources that it needed. And because the Council on Foreign Relations had tremendous connections into the State Department and therefore into the President, Roosevelt at the time, and because behind the scenes the CFR actually was in a higher controlling position than the government itself, that formula came to pass. But in order for it to succeed, there needed to be a tremendous propaganda front that would shape the picture of imperial empire in a completely different way. It wasn't going to be, yes, we're going to conquer the world and everybody's on board and let's go. It was the greatest good for the greatest number of people. We're all in this together. It's for a better world. We have to do what's necessary to make humanity rise up. And all of these cliches that were sprayed out from the time of the end of the Second World War. And as this retired propaganda master, Ellis Medavoy, told me on several occasions, this was a real overarching plan, and it was very detailed in how it was to be executed, that everybody from educational to religious institutions to government to even corporations, anybody who had any sort of public voice was now going to be bombarded with information that would lead them to believe that we were on the dawn of a better world if we would just all think of ourselves as, quote, part of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a picture that was now painted to cover over the fact that what was really going on was imperial conquest all over the world, which has continued to this day, of course. And so there you see some of the roots of modern collectivism as complete hype and charade and delusion that's intentionally spread so that people are, their minds are tapped into by these propagandists in a place where, you know, everybody would like to see things get better in general terms, whatever that means. Everybody would like to see the world getting along with itself, sure. And into that part of the mind comes all of this propaganda that leads to something, for example, like the overwhelming election of Obama in 2008, where there was really, it came to a climax in a way in this orgasm of hysteria about the need to have this president because he was a transcendent figure. And why was he transcendent? Because he could see the big picture of all of humanity, and politics would never be the same again. And so this was promoted as electioneering, and it worked. And we can see the disastrous results in the aftermath.
Sure can. Now, if we go back to education, John Dewey was a prominent figure behind today's compulsory public education in America and a socialist, and he vehemently opposed the idea of an individual in a free society where the individual is respected. And in fact, he said that it's the government that must decide how each individual is best to serve it. Can you believe that?
Unfortunately, I can. I studied John Dewey in college when I was taking philosophy courses, and the cover story on an academic level at the time was that he was the voice, one of the voices of a new American philosophy called pragmatism, or what some people called instrumentalism, which meant that everything had to be viewed in terms of its effect, that no statements were really true or false. They only would lead to something effective or ineffective. And so it followed from that that in his educational theories, he would promote the idea that the individual is just a unit in a larger equation, and that government would be shaping the future. And therefore, the whole educational system, well, by implication, would have to be geared to wiping out the sense of the individual who survives and blooms on his own terms and on his own achievements. So achievement really took a tremendous torpedo in the wake of Dewey and other such educational theorists, because if you left in education the idea of individual achievement being important, then you would give credence to the whole idea of the independent individual,
mm-hmm.
which was anathema to these people. They couldn't stand for that, so they had to reduce everything to what is good for the group, what should be the curriculum of the group, what should be dropped out of the curriculum, and of course what was dropped out was the original founding documents of the country, why the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were written as they were, why the idea of severely limited government was put into effect, and the only possible answer that you would see out of those founding documents was that the individual took precedence, that the government was supposed to exist on behalf of freeing up the individual to achieve what he wanted to achieve in life. And so this was completely scratched out of educational curriculum, completely gone. And I got in as a young person being educated just, I would say, before the full force of that program hit. And so when I went back into schools as a teacher, oh, maybe 5, 6, 7 years after I was out of college, the change was just staggering. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't any longer about who's smart, who's achieving, who's doing the work, who's an independent thinker, who has talent. All of that was just completely destroyed.
Yeah, now we're probably being told, and I bet a lot of the kids are being taught to, it's selfish and greedy to promote freedom for the individual. You can't just be thinking about yourself anymore. This is a thing of the past. The concept of being an individual is, it's a myth. We're in this together, like you say, so get with it. Right?
Yeah, that is what's happening. And I don't know, on the last interview we did, I quoted a sociologist from a California university who basically wrote just what you said, that the concept of the individual is now defunct. It no longer has any credence. And it was just a sort of artificial construct. And now everything has to be about what is good for the group. And these social science people have contributed an enormous amount to destroying the whole idea of the individual. And a word about them: coming out of the Second World War, many of these people who became professors of the social sciences, like sociology and anthropology and so forth, were people who were working in psychological operations, warfare operations. And they needed jobs. They needed positions of authority. And so they were put into a new discipline called mass communications, which really was a pseudo-discipline. It had no real underpinning at all, but it was just a way to allow them to keep influencing society, which they did. And they did it by studying groups, cultures, nations, tribes, clans, but never the individual. Never did any of these people ever write, well, I was in with this tribe in South America, and one of the interesting things I noticed was that there were individuals in this group who were different from the rest of the group, which, of course, is always the case in any group, but mm-hmm. you would never know that from reading their work. And in fact, I remember a guy, this was probably in the 1980s, who had lived for maybe a dozen years with a tribe in South America. And he kept telling people after he came back and they asked him what it was like, he said, it was like being with any group of people. There are the good guys, the bad guys, the people who go along with everything, the independent-minded people. He said, forget the gloss of, you know, what is the group? It's not the way it is. Once you're inside long enough and you're accepted, it becomes like any other just random bunch of people. There are all kinds of individuals. But of course, this was completely erased by the social science people because they wanted to promote through education mainly that the coming wave is, in fact, the group, the collective. It's all about that. That's what you study. That's what you learn about. And you're not concerned with the individual at all because that doesn't even exist.
Jeez.
Well, yes.
The state also hates the individual. So tell us about the individual versus the planned state, which is another aspect.
Yes. Again, going back to World War II, these social scientists, who are not really scientists at all, but really propagandists, they assumed as a basic foundation for their work that all nations, all societies, had to be planned societies. They just took that for granted. And it was implicit in everything they wrote. because if it wasn't, then what good was their academic discipline? It was just something to, you know, sort of entertain yourself with. But they were much more serious about it. They were basically intellectual legislators, if you will, who were saying, look, we now have the capacity, technologically and in every other way, to study groups and study societies. But why? What's the purpose? Well, obviously the purpose is so that we can plan these societies, how they will work, how they'll operate, who's in charge, what will be distributed to whom, on what terms, what the laws will be, the regulations, and so forth, because that's the future. That's where we're going. And so that's why we need to learn about various societies, so we can apply all this to planning the societies of every nation on the face of the earth, which again destroys the whole concept of the individual and individual freedom and the inherent right to decide on one's own future. All of this goes by the boards because, and this has been kind of a tacit assumption throughout governments as well, that most commentators ignore. They just don't want to expose that because it's too hot a wire to touch. They realize that if the population at large understood that, hey, you know, we're dealing in planned societies. This is what all this propaganda and social science and education and government is about, is to how to plan society so that everything is organized and everybody fits into a slot. If that becomes really public knowledge, then people are going to rebel. So we have to conceal that assumption behind all of this stuff that we put out there. But that's the world that we're living in now. The people that run things don't even bother to think about this anymore. They're just working off of the assumption that it's all about which kind of a planned society is better, more efficient than another kind. And that's all they're concerned about.
Have you heard about the planned, quote-unquote, utopian socialist eco-future city called Owenstown in Scotland that the Mondragon Corporation is trying to build?
No, I haven't. I've just gotten a little tidbit, so tell me about this.
It's very creepy. It's basically based on the worker-owned co-op in Mondragon, Spain. There's some great videos you can watch about it, but it's very, very creepy. Everything is fair and everything is owned together. No one has more than you. And it feels completely contrived. It's not organic. Like you said, it's a set-up, planned community. And everyone's got their little peg that they fit into. Everyone's got their little place, and it looks like the neighbor's place. It's like you can't even scratch your butt without going through the community first.
Oh, wow. And how do they plan to fill this city, you know?
They're trying to say that they're trying to get people to come live there and be a part working in their business that they have there, some kind of industry, some sort of factory.
Wow.
So they're trying to lure people in. Yeah, you'll have to check out some videos about it. Henrik showed me some stuff, and I was very creeped out by it.
And is this sort of like a corporate government partnership?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I'm expecting to see a lot more of this. A lot more of this.
Yeah, and it was dubbed
because
Model Village for the 21st Century.
Exactly. And look how well it's working, and then it becomes publicized, and let's start some more of these. And, you know, the social scientists will be like vultures, you know, feeding off of this to publish studies and reports, and there'll be glowing articles in the New York Times, and, you know, you're going to find this whole idea spreading for sure, because these are like, you know, beacons of collectivism that will be hailed as the new wave, the new way of living.
Ugh. And then if you want more, or if you want to go outside of that, maybe you want to paint your place a little different color, you get looked at and judged. That's not freedom to me.
Right, exactly. Peer pressure of everybody saying, this is not the right thing, you can't do this.
Yeah, what are you complaining about, Lana? You have what you need. You have food, you have shelter. Just shut up, you know. Do your job.
Exactly, exactly. That's the whole message.
They also seem to hide behind we're a sustainable community. You notice that?
Yeah, the sustainability is always the, you know, the rationalization behind this. You see, we're not harming the environment. Everybody else is, but we're not, because, you know, we recycle everything from paper to people's kidneys to whatever there is here. We can recycle it and use it again. And so therefore, this is good for the planet. It feeds into the radical environmental movement, which is really at the top, all about depopulation and control of society, and also the destruction of industrial society by laying on, you know, just intolerable taxes for producing anything and intolerable red tape for producing anything, so that eventually the hope of these people and their objective is that more and more businesses become government-controlled, de facto government-controlled businesses. You know, the government is really your partner because you're paying exorbitant taxes. You're involved in red tape up to the hilt. There are many things that you're not allowed to do. And so really, you know, it's like you're a little government agency. And if you make too much money, then you can be taxed more. You will be taxed more to bring you down to the level of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Under the fiction that your taxes are going to make a better world and to bring the people who are suffering up to the level of everybody else. But this is a gigantic myth. I mean, if you look at the God knows how many billions and billions and maybe trillions of dollars have supposedly gone from federal and state governments in the United States into inner cities, which are racked with poverty and drugs and crime over the last, let's say, 45 to 50 years, and then look at the results, it's an absolute catastrophe.
Oh, yeah.
Things have only gotten worse, much, much worse. And so if that's where the money is going, that comes from entrepreneurs being taxed much more heavily, it's a complete and total failure, you know, in the negative realm, under zero. And you can watch these programs all over the world. I mean, there is no real intention to raise the level of standard of living. So that's also a hoax. So the collectivist motto, you know, we're all in this together, that's already a hoax as far as the individual goes, because it's attempting to eradicate the individual. And then when you look at the actual results of these programs, say in the third world, you're astonished to find that after all these years and all these studies have been written that show that chronic disease in the third world is basically caused by contaminated water supplies and lack of basic sanitation, overcrowding, as well as the dangerous effects of vaccines and toxic pharmaceuticals to add into the mix, lack of basic nutrition, and land stolen by corporations from the people who live there with the aid of their local governments. All of this is very well known, and the means to fix it are not that expensive and certainly not that difficult. But yet it hasn't happened. It's never happened. You don't see corporations going in there into, you know, some part of an African country and saying, look, for $12 million, we can decontaminate 65 to 70% of your water supply. It's easy. We have the technology. That's all it'll take. And somehow it never happens.
Yep.
You know? So the result of all of this is horrific, along with the fakery of the ideals to begin with.
But yet people think, oh, this is a product of capitalism or the free market. But they don't understand that when a government is in bed with companies and telling them what to do, this is not free market. This is not capitalism.
Yeah, that is another thing that is becoming completely twisted. Now, you see people who seem to be otherwise intelligent just using the word capitalism at random as a synonym for destruction, you know, the hatred of the few for the many, the overwhelming attempt to dominate the many by the few, crime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when by and large, what capitalism really means is the free market, if one, you know, existed anywhere, where you could have people developing and selling products completely unhindered by the government and untortured by the government. And that's a good thing. It's always a good thing. But yet, no. This is now being, you know, heralded as sinful behavior that has to stop. And, you know, I would say along with that, especially, I've been told about this. Let's see, I was on a radio program, I think, from Norway. The number of people throughout the country that actually work for one form of the government or another. And in the United States, this number keeps advancing all the time. If you look at the number of people who are working for some form of local or state or federal government or the military or the police, some agency of the government somewhere, that number, the last time I tried to calculate it, turned out to be something on the order of 1 out of every 10 people.
Oh, geez.
So you know where their sympathies lie.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where their paycheck is. So whatever the government wants, these people are going to go along with, and they have no background or experience or feeling of victory from having done exactly in their lives what they wanted to do and making it a success. So naturally, they're going to be very suspicious of that, especially because it's against everything that their employer, in this case the government, stands for. And so you're going to get an increasing, you're already getting it, and especially under Obama now, but it's been, you know, all modern presidents. More and more government, more and more people working for government, more and more people owing their lives and their survival to government. And so to them, collectivism is absolute common sense on the level of what it takes for them to survive in the world.
Well, yeah, then really. Aren't these people that can't hack it on their own kind of like children? So they want to go run to daddy to take care of them. They want to have that safety net there all the time.
You bet.
So they actually fear the idea of freedom and a free society because they know in their heart of hearts that they can't really hack it.
That's right. So now if you want to talk about a, you know, sociological problem, and here's another area that sociologists don't dare to tread in, it would be, what is the profile of people who work for government? That's a group you could study and come up with some very interesting factors. Way back in 1964, I got a job for a few months as a social worker in Los Angeles. I think it was the county of Los Angeles, and I worked out of a big office downtown. And two things that I remember very much about that is, one, I was sent out to interview a woman. It was a routine interview to renew her welfare payments. She had, I think, two children, and the program was called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. Well, in her case, she was the only parent. And so during the interview, because I was completely naive and just was kind of winging the whole thing, I said, do you think there's ever going to be a prospect that you'll find a job? And she looked at me like I was totally insane, completely and utterly insane. This was 1964. And so I was, you know, I was as shocked as she was mm-hmm. by her reaction. It's like, well, I guess, you know, this is what we're dealing with here. This is a permanent underclass. And there's no way that this is going to shrink. It's only going to get bigger and more overwhelming. And by the way, if you then added into the number of people who work for the government in some capacity, all the people who are receiving some form of government subsidy, now you're talking about maybe 1 out of 4 or 3 Americans. Because we've got 50 million people on food stamps. And who knows how many other people on different types of government subsidy. And the other thing that happened was I sat in on a meeting one day of caseworkers at this welfare, county welfare agency. And they were talking about, I think it was the 1964 election, and how, you know, LBJ had to win because he was running against Goldwater and so forth and so on. And I just looked at the faces of the people in the room. And it was a chilling tale that those expressions told. It was like these caseworkers were as dedicated as the recipients were to perpetuating the system forever, without end. That nobody was in the slightest bit interested in getting anybody off of welfare, really. That was just, you know, unless it was mandated by law that, you know, after whatever, 4 or 5 years, the payments would stop. As far as the people in the room were concerned, this was forever. And they were dedicated to it, and this is where they were going to spend the rest of their lives doing this. Ugh. So that's, you know, 35, almost 50 years ago now. And so you can see what's happened since then. And this is a deliberate attempt to completely, really outlaw the individual as a significant force, most of all for himself or herself in the world. That is the objective. If you can erase and eradicate the individual so that he or she no longer thinks of himself as an independent individual with his own thoughts, ideas, dreams, visions, and determination to achieve something in life, then the battle is over. Then the whole ship sinks. Then everything is underwater. Then the entire society is now run by government command from the top, of course, in partnership with corporations and other, you know, heavy hitter players like Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what we see happening in front of our eyes.
I noticed, too, people always want to point the fingers at it's those evil corporations, you know, they've stolen our money. The only way they've stolen your money is through taxes. So you should be pointing the finger at government. And if you don't like these corporations, you don't have to buy what they're selling. They're not coming to your house, putting a gun to your head and saying, buy our cell phone, you know?
Yeah, I have some personal experience with this because in 1995 or so, I started something called the Great Boycott of the 8 largest corporations in the world that produce pesticides, genetically engineered food, and pharmaceutical drugs. I said, well, you know, let's boycott these corporations. And so I wrote up this long white paper, and the original name of it was Revolt Against the Empire. And it was the idea, okay, these corporations are evil because they're promoting poison and they're selling it and nobody's stopping them from doing it. So the only alternative we have is to boycott their products. So don't buy these products, period. Well, eventually it turned into a kind of an educational seminar because a lot of people became clued in on what these corporations were actually doing it, and I think it spawned a number of journalistic efforts and maybe some books and so forth. But the actual participation in the boycott, people were just unwilling to acknowledge at the root just what you just said. Hey, if it's a corporation and you don't like what they're selling, don't buy it. It's very simple. But why weren't these people, the general public, or some, you know, significant fraction, able to see that equation? Because they weren't able to see themselves as individuals who had a choice about anything.
Yeah, they wait for the FDA to tell them it's safe.
Exactly. Exactly. And if the FDA didn't say this is a threat to you, then they would just go along. Because that's what they do. They go along. And of course, the other side of this coin is what is the individual when he or she is independent, free, can think clearly about his own aims and objectives and has the creative power to make it happen. That is what is being lost in the world, and that has to be regained.
I think it's interesting, too, that modern collectivists, they see a collectivist society as some kind of super organism, some supernatural entity that's apart from us, yet many of them are atheists, but then all of a sudden it seems like they're getting metaphysical and talking about utopian philosophy when it comes to this particular subject matter. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a key point. It's a religion for them because they have nothing to believe in. I'm not saying that you have to have a religion, but I am saying that many people, if they come to the conclusion that they have no religious faith themselves, will look for it somewhere else, even though they would never acknowledge that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want this supernatural rationalization. You know, it's not enough even for them to say, I'm a socialist. This is what I believe in. Society should be planned and structured and this and that, and this is why. No, it's more like, this is the future. This is utopia. This is what humanity has been striving for the last 100,000 years, and we're finally going to reach this exalted state. And yes, it is very mystical, and they see it as some sort of spiritual union of all souls, of, you know, minds, etc., etc. And this is where technocracy comes in as well. It's like the big brain. Yes, we'll be able to hook you up to a computer that's 50 times or 5,000 times more powerful than your own brain, works the same way, and then you will be super empowered, and so will everybody else. And so we could essentially have one giant brain that everybody plugs into, and what they sort of fail to tell you is that, yeah, but in that system, everybody's going to come to the same conclusions because they're going to be acting on the same data and the same processes to derive answers from that data. So it's sort of the smart version of collectivism. You know, this is for the computer geeks and the techno freaks and the people who, you know, they're looking for religion too. And they found it in the machine.
Yeah.
And that's where they're praying, at that altar. Oh, yes, now, you know, I mean, Roy Kurzweil, who's the, you know, research director for Google now, but he's been pounding away as a thinker on these issues for years and written a number of books. You know, he's basically saying that we will find God eventually through this. When you can hook up a human brain to a computer and download into that human brain everything that's in the computer or access it, then we will have reached a point where enough people are so super intelligent that God will emerge as something, whatever it is, out of the machine. I mean, that's how far he'll go with this.
Well,
so this is religion. It's just, you know, with a different face, a weird face.
It kind of reminds me, too, when you're talking about the Venus Project. Have you heard about that?
No.
Well, okay, Jacques Fresco, he has this kind of utopian resource-based economy. It's socialist with a twist of machines. Basically, no one would work. Instead, machines would do all the jobs, and everyone will get yachts and whatever they dream of. You know, they all get to share, but machines will do all the work. And the question is, well, who's going to program these machines, of course?
Right. Well, this was Buckminster Fuller's vision. Utopia or Oblivion was maybe the clearest statement he ever made about that. Only he based it on a kind of necessity. He said, look, automation is going to take over in production. And that means that millions and millions and maybe more people are going to be thrown out of jobs eventually, and what's going to happen when that happens? And so he argued for a similar kind of society in which there would be a stable platform of everybody in the world is given the basic necessities of survival. But again, the fatal flaw, or one of them in his system, was who is going to run this show?
Yeah.
You know, and the government is going to run this show. Some corporation or two or three is going to run this show. And the rest of everybody just trusts that this is all going to work out, and that there's nothing sinister or criminal behind such a program. There's always something sinister behind a program like this.
Exactly.
You know, and it's always anti-individual. It's always for the collective. This propaganda element in collectivism is tremendously crucial for people to buy into, as far as the controllers are concerned, because if they don't, then the whole thing is going to fall apart. If there are enough people out there who say, you know, I see through this, it's completely insane. I'm not my neighbor. You know, my neighbor isn't me. I am not everybody else. Or if I can, on some level, merge with everybody else, I can unmerge just as easily. This is not some final hardwired state, which when you reach, it's the end of the line. That's mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
You know, and this is why the propaganda is so important, because it's the underpinning of the whole collectivist model. People have to, on a subconscious level, and through peer pressure and so forth, you know, I can't paint my house the color I want to paint it. Well, that's good, because I'm now going along with what everybody else thinks, and I have to, in order to preserve this utopian, you know, community or whatever. That's the kind of thinking that has to work in order for this to succeed, this collectivist planet, and people have to buy in. They have to accept it more and more every day. And this is why you get, for example, the aftermath in the wake of all of these mass shootings. We now have to do something about this. All of us have to do something about the fact that some guy went crazy and opened up and shot a whole lot of people, or he didn't, but somebody was sent in there to actually do it and then blame it on him. But in the aftermath, either way, it's always this sentiment about we're all in this together, mm-hmm. and we have to find a better way, and now this better way is going to be, take guns away from everybody, and then two, make everybody into, you know, a psychiatric patient, basically. That's the long range view. Everybody has to be under some care of a, you know, mental health professional, get a diagnosis, get drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And that will prevent this kind of thing from happening again. These things are always used. And as well, you get the sort of subliminal text here, which is, you see, it was the individual who's the bad guy,
yeah.
The outsider, the lone shooter, the criminal. Any individual is a criminal, basically, is the sort of, you know, the equation that's laid on people. And this would never have happened if we were all in this together. You know, never would have happened. And now we have to do something to make sure that we are in this together, and we have to do all these things, you know.
Yeah, it's the notion that anything society does is right because, well, society chose to do it. Ridiculous.
That's right. As if we all sat in some gigantic stadium and we all voted, right?
Yeah.
And we all knew what we were voting on. Yeah, well, this is what society is doing, and therefore it's a good thing. So if you were to dare to speak out and say, the welfare system in America has destroyed millions, untold millions of people over the years, nobody in official circles would give you a microsecond of their time. It would just be, oh, here's a lunatic. Okay, forget it. Let's go on to the next thing. We don't want to hear about it. We want to know about it. And certainly we don't want to actually consider the facts, because then it would derail the whole, you know, people might begin to say, well, maybe collectivism isn't the best idea. maybe we have to look to something else. And of course, that's verboten. Can't have that. Impossible.
No. What do you think about the socialists who say, well, food and shelter should be a human right?
Yeah, food and shelter should be a human right.
Like someone else should give it to you if you don't work for it.
Right. And that's the catch, see? Because, you know, I know a whole lot of people who, if you said that to them, they would say, you mean I can get that? And you'd say, yeah, sign me up right now. The temptation is enormous. And I'm not just talking about people who, you know, in their own minds say, I can't work, I can't hold a job, I can't function in society. I'm talking about millions of people who can function. But you give them that out, and over the years, there are going to be just enormous numbers of people who take it. And in taking it, they're going to destroy themselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when you go to the park. Just the other day, I was at a park and says, don't feed the alligators because, you know, you're going to kill them basically if you do, because they get dependent on the food and then they stop looking for it on their own.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I understand if, you know, you get the society where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And you say, that's not justice. And it isn't, because this is not happening in a free market economy. It's happening in a planned economy.
Yeah.
In other words, the people who run the economy and run the country are planning to have this extreme division get wider and the gulf get wider and wider. And people have to understand that. Mm-hmm. That's the plan, you know. The plan isn't for a utopia. That's the cover story. That's the baloney up front that's supposed to convince people that they have to go for this utopian vision. So when you have a situation like that, where through crime, basically, continuing organized crime at the highest levels, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and nobody's prosecuting the criminals, then sure, you're going to have lots of people that are hurting. You bet. Now, to go from there, though, and to say that the solution to this is to give everybody food and shelter is just playing into the hands of the people who are destroying the population with their plan of rich getting richer and poor getting poorer.
Yeah.
Because it's just going to put people in a situation where you're going to have millions more people who just sit around and watch television all day because their rent and food is covered. That's what's going to happen. And so what are the chances that those millions of people are going to rebel against this plan? Zero. Less than zero.
But the people that provide the jobs and work will take off. I mean, we saw that happening in Sweden. All the young entrepreneurs that have brilliant ideas, they leave Sweden to achieve their dreams and goals because they can't do it in that kind of collectivist society where they tax you to death before you even make a move.
Right. And the places where they can go are getting scarcer and scarcer.
Yeah, it's true.
It's not like, well, there's 15 countries we know we can really do great in. Maybe. You know, the controls are getting tighter. And then you have people who would say, you know, like, maybe it's still that way, I don't know. But it used to be that in America, people looked at Sweden and said, man, I wish I could live there. Because look, everything is great. People are happy. You know, it's basically a kind of a welfare state. And nobody really has to work that hard, and fantastic. And then you say, yeah, okay, so what are the taxes like over there? How much of what you make do you have to give to the government? And so then if you scratch below the surface, it sort of turns out that, yeah, life is okay if, first of all, you have no questions about the way society is run and you keep your mouth shut. And two, you pay what the government tells you to pay to them. And you work at your job and you keep your head down, and that's it. That's your life. And if that's what you want, or if that's what you can convince yourself you want, then okay. Within those boundaries, I guess you could say, I'm happy, it's okay. And unfortunately, that's a whole lot of people.
Yeah. But they also seem to think they're still going to have their bling and everything America has to offer while it's a socialist system. No way. Everything goes down the tubes. It goes down to the lowest common denominator. The standards of everything goes way down. I know the apartments people live in Sweden. It's not great.
I see. Okay. I'm interested in the details of that.
Yeah, I mean, they just have enough money to go to the Systembolaget, you know, the government-controlled liquor store, and they drink themselves silly. They have a high alcohol, high suicide rate because they're so controlled from every angle. They're taxed. Even your dog is taxed. Your TV is taxed. The media is run by government. I mean, you get it on every angle there. It's no utopia. But it's fine. Wow. Exactly like you said, you just want to keep your head down and shut up and not strive for anything more, or want to look to something bigger and greater, then it's great for you. But for someone like me, it's the kiss of death. It's death to my soul and my body.
You bet. Yeah, I mean, these are the facts that are overlooked when somebody paints a rosy picture of another place. They say, gee, it's great here. Yeah, so why is everybody an alcoholic and committing suicide if it's so great? Is that part of having a happy life? Yeah, I'm just a happy drunk and I think I'll kill myself. Terrific. You know, it doesn't add up. And it never has added up. And, you know, it's if a person has any responsibility at all, the first responsibility is to figure out what it is that they actually want in life.
Yeah.
In the largest terms possible. Not like, you know, I want to convert my fingernail polish salon so that it carries 12 colors of polish rather than 10. Something a little bit bigger, shall we say. What is that you truly want? And then to take a good look at that and say, okay, now how do I get that? What do I really, really want? And that, you know, is not no longer part of public discourse.
No.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What does that mean? You know. And so these documents, sentiments, ideals, principles have been trashed one way or another, you know, for the last 50 years without let up. And the school systems have completely erased any significant teaching of American history. I remember even when I was in school in the 40s and the early 50s, I don't know what they taught in those classes, but whatever it was, I never learned it. It was the most dull, boring kind of stuff there was. And nobody ever said, now this is important and this is why it's important. Because the way you're living your life now and your parents are living their lives is predicated on what happened all those years ago. And if that stuff didn't happen, here's how you might be living now. So why don't we look at what happened back then and the people who made it happen and see what that's all about? You know, that was never spoken.
Mm.
So it was a total sham. And I have to say that that went on even into college, because we had a course that was mandatory called American Studies. And they were reports and studies that were published in a series about different periods in American history. And we would study these studies and we would write about them and talk about them in class. And never did I get the feeling that there was anything, you know, thrilling, uplifting, exciting, inspiring about any of this, really. It was all just sort of dried out dust that you could argue about. And maybe even worse yet, when I started to study the classical philosophers of Greece, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, mainly, it was never explained. And I only realized this years later when I was trying to think about why I felt it was so boring. It was never explained that there had never been anything like this in the history of the world before. That some guy named Plato was suddenly writing dialogues with his teacher Socrates as one mouthpiece and some prominent citizen as another mouthpiece, and they were discussing issues about freedom and so forth and justice and all of this. And regardless of the conclusions that Plato came to, which I think were disastrous, it was the first time that this sort of conversation had ever been written down and this sort of freedom existed to explore these issues anywhere on the planet. It was unprecedented, and what came before it was just a sort of a nightmare of dynasties and top-down control and the priest class who made all decisions for everybody and mass slavery and so forth and so on. So you can see in the educational system the total disintegration of any reality that would give students an idea that they were working with ideas that were alive and important and had to do with the individual.
Yeah.
In 4 years of college, and this was way back in the 1950s and going up to 1960, I don't think that I really ever heard any professor or teacher bring up the individual in any serious context.
Yeah, I can't think of one either.
Yeah. Okay, when did you go to school?
Well, I'm 34, but I went to college, actually minored in philosophy, and I found that it was very, very just skin deep. We didn't really go there, you know?
Yeah.
It's very topical.
So it's just continued and gotten worse.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all intentional. I mean, as you pointed out with Dewey, and there were other people as well, the Carnegie Foundation, right up there in the Rockefeller Foundation, they all decided that we had to have a planned society and that the individual was out.
Right.
You know, it's like, you're out, baby. You have no more status. That's it. Meanwhile, we, you know, the individuals who run these foundations, oh, yeah, we're going to be individuals, but all we care about is controlling everybody else and painting the picture that collectivism is a wonderful thing. And that's our strategy. And we'll do whatever it takes to enforce it. But we have to get people to believe in it, to buy it, because we're not ready to just hold down the whole country at the point of a gun. Not a country like the U.S. We don't want to go that far, because we know that that's going to incite massive rebellion. What we want to do is make it a soft, gradual, creeping acceptance, so that people can't think any other way.
I can think of two recent examples where this is creeping in. Maybe it's the Fabian Society style. There's a college professor in Seattle who was recently elected, and she is an open socialist, and she was elected into the city council, and she's advocating a straight takeover of companies. I mean, that is just straight up communism. And then we have Russell Brand, who's promoting his new age socialist egalitarian system, which everyone got all excited about. Don't ask me why.
Yeah. I think because in either tone, manner, or direct statement, he somehow connected that with freedom. And this is something else I think that's really, you know, a mind control issue here. Because, you know, as Orwell obviously pointed out, 1984, you twist the meaning of words, you give them new senses of what they are and what they imply and what they connect to and so forth. And after a while, it's like hitting somebody over the head and driving them from pillar to post. They don't know which way is up. So in the same breath, you can say freedom and you can say socialism and you can say egalitarianism, and people will buy it as if they all go together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this sounds great. Freedom, yeah. Okay, freedom and socialism and everybody's equal and it's all in one pot. Fantastic, you know. Except when you start to take it apart and say, well, what do you mean by freedom in this context? You find out there isn't any.
Nope.
You know, yeah, you're free to be a ward of the state.
Yep.
And if you don't like that, then you're exiled out into the darkness. and you're not part of society anymore. And now you're considered to be a criminal. I think the anniversary of JFK's murder is, you know, also an occasion to look at this, because it was the first example in my lifetime that I was aware of where the individual was portrayed as the lone criminal, the insane outsider who was, you know, bent on destruction at the highest possible level. And in the wake of that, it was, you know, the safety and security of the group. That the nation, in order to be held together, somehow had to make sure that this did not happen again. It was an issue of national security and so forth and so on. And that cover story, you know, completely obscured all the underground investigations that were going on that started about 5 minutes after Kennedy was shot, by people who just saw through the whole insane scenario and realized that this had nothing to do with the truth. But it was used as a way of marginalizing the individual. See, this is what the individual would do if left to his own devices. And this became, you know, a marching song more and more in later generations. This is what the individual would do. And it really sank the country in a complete doldrum, eventually, and led to these other, you know, mass shootings and killings where the killer becomes a celebrity and all of this kind of thing. Well, yeah, this is another example of individualism. This is what an individual will do if he's not part of the group, part of the group. And this is what we have to fight.
Yeah.
You know, and it never ends. I mean, I was in nursery school. 43 in New York. I was totally clueless. I mean, I was just, you know, I don't even know how to describe what I was. I was like somebody from Mars who had suddenly been parachuted down to Earth when I went into this classroom, and a teacher said something to me, and I said, okay. And she said, no, we don't say okay, we say all right. And I suddenly discovered they had all these rules for what you could say and didn't say or couldn't say, and that everything in this little nursery school was about behavior and part of the group. And you got little awards. I mean, it was 1943.
Yeah.
You got little awards for behaving. You know, oh, he was good today and whatever, and let's all applaud this. And, you know, the most polite student. And all of this was held up because you were part of the group. I mean, this is like sheer insanity.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, what people don't seem to get, and you've talked about this too, is that collectivism, it's not about a mass outpouring of share and care. I mean, it's coming down from the top of the ladder, from an elite group that wants to control everything. But all of a sudden, all these collectivists, communists, socialists, they seem to be okay with an elite ruling group in this case.
Yeah, in no other case are they okay.
Yeah.
The capitalists, you know, are the fiends, the killers, the despoilers of humanity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we'll let them in. You know, the same guys. We'll let them in at the top to run things as long as everything else is egalitarian. And I'm sure it's all going to work out just fine. You know, that's where this thing becomes complete madness, you know, complete insanity. It's like you can only take the group so far. You know, there are certain causes and issues and so forth where organizing can really do you some good. Yeah, of course. I've been involved in some of these over the years. But there's a limit to how far they can operate and work. And as an example, I would take the union movement in America. Because I recall 1960, going back that far, I had a friend who worked at a radio station in New York, and he was a real innovator. And he was working with one of the radio hosts, and they decided they were going to put on little theatrical productions because this radio station was now going to do some television. And they were going to do comic sketches. Well, that meant that they had to put up a set, and they had to do this and do that, and all of a sudden it was the union guys that had to be involved with this little project. And so the costs ballooned out of sight.
Yeah.
And he would come home from work with his blood boiling, saying, these guys just sit around. They don't do anything. And they expect to collect their paycheck. And if you don't use them, then the entire union will strike against the station and will go out of business. And this would happen day after day after day after day. You know, it's like, I'm part of a collective, and you can't intimidate me because my group is all powerful.
Yeah.
That's where it always goes.
And they completely disrespect the boss or the inventor or someone who owns the company. They try and put themselves on the same level all the time and disrespect that person. And they want to take over their company. It's amazing. You know, the power of the workers. You couldn't do this without us. But you wouldn't even have the job if it weren't for the guy who came up with the idea.
Right. You didn't build it. Which, you know, I was really recently watching a video, Larkin Rose. And he was saying, let me just give you an example of government versus no government. He said, here I have, he was standing in the woods. He said, I have this little gadget in my pocket, took out a cell phone. He said, with this, I can talk to anybody anywhere in the world. Just this little thing. Now, the government didn't make this thing. Other people did. And I bought it. Now I can use it. So now you're going to tell me that government is absolutely essential because unless we had government, we wouldn't have any roads.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Right? So he said, what's a road? It's a flat place. That's it. It's a flat place. It enables you to get from A to B rather easily. So you're going to tell me that I can hold, you know, this here, I got the cell phone that can do all these things, but private individuals could never build roads. Only the government can build roads. Right?
It's ridiculous.
As if these politicians were out there, you know, hacking away at the dirt and laying down, you know, asphalt and so forth.
And they provide a bad service where I live. The roads are not good.
Yeah, right. And they'll provide whatever service they want to because it's not their money and it's not their problem. So people are completely brainwashed in this respect. They imagine that all sorts of things are necessary because reality is being manufactured for them so that it appears that collectivist solutions are the only things that are going to work. Or it appears that top-down control is the only thing that's going to keep us safe or make things work. And that's part and parcel of reality that's manufactured for people. And so they find themselves unable to wake up from that manufactured reality. They're literally hypnotized. And one of my late associates from the 1980s and 90s, Jack True, who is a brilliant hypnotherapist, would illustrate to me in so many different ways in his work with patients how this was happening at the level of mind, this trance at deeper levels of subconscious where there was an acceptance of externally manufactured reality and how you could unhook people from that. But that you would encounter significant resistance because there's such an overwhelming desire on the part of many people to buy this manufactured reality and to go along with its principles. And that it really is a form of hypnotism and that it affects untold numbers of people. So this I found very inspiring. And interviewed some of his patients and talked to Jack a lot about various methods that he used with people. Eventually, he stopped doing hypnosis altogether because, as he said, people were already coming in hypnotized when they first walked into his office. So the idea was, what at the level of mind is going on so that people accept this collectivist reality that is being manufactured for them? What is happening there? What kind of hypnotism is this? What's the trance? And of course, it's not the kind of trance where you see zombies walking around the street primarily. What you see are active people who are going here, there, doing this, that. But at some core level, they are in a trance state. And they do buy the collectivist myth.
Yeah. It's submerged in there somehow. It is in there.
Very much so in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I like this quote from, I'm going to pull it out from your article, The Rebel Against the Controlled World. I said, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, not with a whimper, but with a heavily armed, surveilled Disneyland. Everyone takes the same rides and eats the same cotton candy. In this cartoon called reality, whoever declines and defects is re-educated."
Yeah.
It's so true. This new form of collectivism, socialism, communism, whatever you want to say, it's going to have a different face to it. And you're right. It is like a surveilled Disneyland. Everyone's eating the cotton candy and has no idea that they're in prison.
Exactly. That's the perfection of the idea, when nobody knows that they're living in a manufactured reality, but they just accept the terms of it. And, you know, there have been a few experiments that have been done to more or less show that people will bend to peer pressure, conformity, and accept certain terms of reality that are just absurd. You know, the famous Milgram experiments, where volunteers were induced to deliver what they thought were electric shocks to people who were sitting, you know, behind a partition, who were actually actors hired to scream and so forth, because these people were giving the wrong answers to questions or being non-responsive or whatever. And how, through an authority figure like the researcher, many of these volunteers in the experiment could be nudged into even giving higher levels of shocks, or what they thought were shocks, accompanied by louder screams and so forth, just because that's reality, just because, well, this researcher must know what's best, and I'm just following along with what's going on, you know. So the Disneyland cartoon-esque aspect of this, I think, is highly significant, because if you can entrain people to believe in that kind of reality, then it all looks like fun, at a sort of low level of fun, you know. Cotton candy, hot dogs, you go on a ride, you walk around, you pay money, you do all these sorts of, you know, crazy little things. Only it's not just on a Sunday afternoon, it's like every day, all day, you know. And so people look at you and say, well, what's the problem? And if you try to say, well, don't you see? No, I don't. I don't know what you're talking about. Don't know what you're talking about.
Jeez. So where are we heading, John?
Well, we're heading in that direction. But at the same time, there is a kind of counter-revolution that's taking place, and I think largely because of the internet, that people are breaking out. And they may start at the level of, you know, I've been cheated. The system has deluded me into thinking X, Y, Z. And there are criminals out there who are pretending that they are the government, or pretending there are huge toxic corporations or whatever. And then the next step is to see how they've been actually you know, buying and drinking the Kool-Aid themselves and sacrificing their own unique individuality on the altar of whatever it is, you know, having a job, conforming, fitting in, living a life according to the plan of their family, on whatever level it is that they begin to see, wait a minute, you know, there's more to this. And I personally see more people waking up to that, that they are realizing that they need to give voice to their own freedom and to do something with it that means something to them individually, not to the group. So I see, you know, more than a glint of hope there. But I also see hope in the fact that when you look at the sheer amount of propaganda, information control, mind control of one kind or another that's been unleashed upon the populace since the dawn of time on this planet, the sheer tonnage of it, that to me is a major clue. It tells you that there is something within the individual that takes a tremendous amount of brainwashing to get them to A, conform, and to stay B, in the realm of conformity and buying into manufactured reality. If it was just a little flip of the hand and this and that, and, you know, this would have been a total slave planet a long time ago. So there is something within individuals that is a tremendous resistance. At the same time that they buy into manufactured reality, there is this other element of self which is diametrically opposed to it. And that's a lot harder to kill off, a lot harder.
I agree. It's the spark of life, and that's ultimately, I think, what they're after. They want to turn that light off.
Exactly. They want to turn that light off. And they do it in a number of ways. You know, another thing that has come down the pipeline to us that is now universally accepted among the elites at different levels, just like the planned society is universally accepted by them, is the conditioned reflex human being as a biological machine. That's a premise they just don't even think about anymore. That's it. What else would you think a human being is? And because we've seen time and time again, they would say historically how dangerous these wild creatures can be if left to their own devices, then naturally we have to find better ways of controlling them. And this is another point of extreme resistance within the individual when he becomes aware that this is what's happening. That there is this kind of a chain of one conditioned, reflex conditioned human being relating to another, to another, to another, to another, all within the sphere of pure Pavlovian response. And that he, some part of him, is standing outside that and isn't buying it. That's another thing where people can begin to see what their own freedom is really like. Because freedom is enormous. That spark of life is really a huge volcano within each individual. Not only as a space, you might say, of in which action can be taken, but as a realm of possibility of what you can do in your own life. And this is one reason why I emphasize so strongly in my work the power of imagination and creative power, because that's really where the spark goes to. That spark of life ignites great imagination of futures, possibilities, unheard of things that do not yet exist, and the creative power to make them happen in the world. And the individual can do this because the individual wants to do this primarily. Not primarily because the individual wants to be a slave to sacrifice himself to the benefit, quote, benefit of others, but because he wants to do whatever, bring about that future that he sees. And then the spillover effects have beneficial values for everybody else. And so, yes, they want to exterminate that spark, and they want to exterminate the possibility that it becomes a conflagration and a great fire. But where it becomes a great fire is within the individual, if he or she would see it that way. Nobody ever said in any of the founding documents of the American Republic that freedom was, individual freedom was severely limited. What they said was that the power to infringe upon freedom was severely limited. And that is something that remains, you know, untaught in schools. But that's a key factor. Freedom has no limit. The only limit it has is that you don't impose or impinge upon the freedom of anybody else. Other than that, the sky is completely open. And this is the kind of renaissance that, you know, that I'm teaching and promoting. And I see individuals waking up to it. I get lots of emails from people indicating in one way or another that, you know, this is happening with them because they finally realized, et cetera, you know, that they were living in a manufactured reality and they want out and they're not going to accept it anymore. This is what the future of the planet depends on.
I'm glad to hear that. John, thanks again for your time this evening. It's always inspiring and a pleasure to hear you speak.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed it, as always. It's great to know that you guys are there because I know what you stand for and that you are, you know, uncompromising to the hilt. And that's not an easy thing to find.
Everyone, please check out John's websites, nomorefakenews.com and johnrappaport.wordpress.com. So, listeners, what is more important, the individual or the group? If you answer the individual, congratulations, you are a true rebel, self-reliant and imaginative. You will go far and wide and succeed in life against all odds. You are a creator, a bold force of nature, unafraid and truly awake. Thanks for listening.
sin.